Today at Reader's Corner, John Valiant, author of Fire Weather, A True Story from a Hotter World. I'm Bob Custer. Welcome to Reader's Corner. In May 2016, Fort McMurray, Alberta, Canada, the hub of Canada's oil industry and America's biggest foreign supplier, was overrun by wildfire. In his latest book, Fire Weather, A True Story from a Hotter World, best-selling author John Valiant warns that this inferno was not a unique event, but a shocking preview of what we must prepare for in a hotter, more flammable world. John Valiant is the author of the best-selling books, The Golden Spruce and The Tiger. His writing has appeared in The New Yorker, The Atlantic, National Geographic, and elsewhere. His debut novel, The Jaguar's Children, was a finalist for the prestigious International Dublin Literary Award. John Valiant, welcome to Reader's Corner.
Hello, Bob. So good to be with you.
Well, John, let's kick this off with your telling us a little bit about the town of Fort McMurray, Alberta, the tar sands that created what you call this one industry town.
Yeah, Fort McMurray is an anomaly in North America. It lies 600 miles due north of Boise, pretty well, in the boreal forest, which is that huge forest system that runs across the top of the northern hemisphere, all the way across Canada and Alaska, into Russia, where it's called the Taiga, all the way across Russia, into Scandinavia, hops over the Atlantic via Iceland and the southern tip of Greenland, picks up again on Newfoundland, and heads back west. So it's this ring of forest around the top of the globe. And in the middle of that is Fort McMurray, which is an isolated city of about 70,000 permanent inhabitants with another 30 or so temporary workers. And really the only reason that city is there in this very isolated setting, 600 miles north of the U.S. border, 600 miles south of the Arctic Circle, is for bitumen. And bitumen is a low-grade petroleum that most of us know as tar. It's what you would seal your driveway with. But there is a deposit right under Fort McMurray about the size of New York State, which, wow, if you were to render it into flammable energy, would rival supplies in Iran and Saudi Arabia. The catch, though, is it being tar, it's bound up in sand up there and has to be melted out literally with billions of cubic feet of natural gas every day. So you're taking a really good energy, natural gas, a useful, easy to render energy, and using it to melt out this bitumen that can ultimately be rendered into diesel and other feedstocks for southern petroleum companies. So that's what people do up there. And you have to excavate hundreds of square miles of forest in order to get at this tar. And they do that with these giant house-sized dump trucks, machines most of us really haven't seen on the road before. And the income up there is also kind of freakishly large. Even in 2016, when the fire broke out, this was 2 years after a global downturn in petroleum prices, the median household income in Fort McMurray was still about $200,000 a year. So it's an extraordinary place, unique in Canada, really unique in North America.
And this fire, the fire started in the forest, and you referred to the boreal forest. Maybe you could help us with just how flammable a boreal forest is, thanks to two or three tree types.
Yeah, so the boreal forest system is flammable by nature. It's not a long-lived system the way jungles might be, or the way the coastal rainforest is. This one is really designed to burn. And in that sense, the boreal is a phoenix among ecosystems. And this is in part because some of the keystone species, especially in Alberta, like black spruce, their cones will not open unless they're heated to temperatures higher than what the sunlight can achieve on its own. So what the fire tells these cones is that the canopy has been cleared above because it's been burnt out, and the ground is clear. And so now these seeds can pop out of the cones and they have a chance to grow a new forest. So colossal fires are actually normal in the Canadian boreal. You can literally have a 1,000 square mile forest fire that won't make the news. What's different now due to climate change is these fires are now burning much more intensely because it's hotter up there than it's ever been, and it's also drier up there than it's ever been.
And I think you refer to the black spruce, which is a beautiful tree, by the way, as fire on a stick, or at least that's what the locals up there refer to it as.
Yeah, the local firefighters call black spruce gas on a
stick. Gas on a stick, yeah.
because it's the needles are loaded with resin. There's a lot of sap in the trunks, and the cones are their own little fire bombs, and they burn like a dry Christmas tree.
So this fire gets out of control and heads for Fort McMurray. By the time it's contained, and that's weeks away, how many homes were destroyed?
Well, the damage was colossal. The fire burnt inside the city limits of Fort McMurray for 5 or 6 days. Active firefighting and homes were still burning. 2 weeks later, work camps where the bitumen workers work were still burning down. 2 weeks later, the fire was not even technically declared extinguished until the following year. So in that time, about 2,500 houses were burned. Thousands more were damaged due to heat, due to neglect, because the entire city was evacuated on the afternoon of May 3rd. It was the biggest, most rapid evacuation due to fire in modern times. And so what you had left was kind of like a Chernobyl-type situation. The city is abandoned, and it's shut down for a month, and mold is growing, and animals are coming in, vermin are coming in. So a lot of additional damage occurred after the fire.
So give us an idea of what that evacuation was like. 88,000 people at least were driven from their homes in one afternoon. And I was particularly interested in the way you credited the Canadian people. Maybe it's the culture. I'm not so sure I could say that down here south of the border for getting the same kind of response. You hear about some of these tornado warnings and watches that come out, and folks are on TV talking about how they're going to stay instead of leave. But what was it about that? I mean, how many deaths were there? And then what do you attribute this incredible evacuation to?
Bob, this is a really important question for public safety. I mean, literally, as you and I are speaking to each other right now, a terrible fire is burning around Valparaiso, Chile. More than 100 people have already died. Hundreds more are missing. At least a couple thousand homes have burned, and this is literally as we're talking to each other. And this is not even considering the terrible death toll in Lahaina, Hawaii last year, and then the one in Paradise, California. And this is a much larger population, tens of thousands of people streaming out of Fort McMurray after the evacuation was in fact called late. So neighborhoods were already in flames as people were trying to escape. And there are a couple of ways of understanding this. I think one, because Fort McMurray is so isolated and it's so labor intensive, like the only reason you go up there is to work and make money. There are not a lot of elders up there. So it's a young, strong population. And because they work in the petroleum industry, they're trained in how to respond to fires, because the petroleum industry is an explosive and dangerous industry. So a lot of the folks there had training. I think there is a law-abiding streak in Canadians, and there was also a lot of police and firefighters who risked their lives to make sure every house was empty. And these are, you know, when the neighborhoods are on fire, it was 1,000 degrees between the houses. It was hotter than the planet Venus. These houses were burning to the ground in 5 minutes. That's how intense and otherworldly the heat was. It was really a firestorm. And in spite of that, firefighters and police and neighbors went house to house to make sure everybody was out. And then they came streaming out on these entrance roads up to these suburbs. And the problem with a lot of new developments all over North America is there's only one road in and one road out. And that, in fact, was the problem with the entire city of Fort McMurray. There's one highway. And so it's honestly kind of a miracle that no one died in the flames. There were fatalities after for various reasons, but it was an extraordinary kind of self-rescue operation and deserves further study.
And what about the spacing of these houses, which is a problem not only in Fort McMurray, but almost anywhere I can think of around here?
Yeah, I think of when you've got building on very valuable land around desirable cities. You know, I imagine you experienced this in Boise and, you know, certainly Seattle, San Francisco, Vancouver, and Fort McMurray. Land's expensive. And so the lots are small and people are trying to build as big as they can. They want a beautiful house for themselves and their family. So in some cases in Fort McMurray, the houses might have been only 5 or 6 feet apart, you know, so you could run from rooftop to rooftop. So what that makes firefighting extraordinarily difficult, because what those narrow spaces between the houses do, they basically act like chimneys. When one is on fire, it sucks air through those narrow channels and basically heats it up like a furnace. And so these houses were basically burning each other down, creating giant kind of neighborhood-wide fire systems. And it's basically impossible for a firefighter with traditional means to combat that. And so they had to resort to some really unorthodox methods up in Fort McMurray.
You're listening to Reader's Corner. My guest today is John Valiant, author of Fire Weather, A True Story from a Hotter World. You also point out that there's something different about the inside of those houses today. And I think you distinguish the modern furnishings from the legacy furnishings. Tell us about that. And then on top of that, you've got whatever is in the garage or in the backyard. And in that area, as you can point out, that's perhaps a little different than most homes.
Yeah, this town, it's a petroleum town. It's basically an oil town, you know, even though they're mining bitumen, but the focus is very much on, you know, big trucks and side-by-sides and RVs and ATVs. And, you know, it's a virtue to burn oil up there. And as a result, a lot of modern houses, because of just the dominance of the petroleum industry in our world now, if you really start looking at what a modern house is made of, vinyl siding is a petroleum product. Tar shingles are a petroleum product. Vinyl windows are petroleum products. A lot of the laminates and glues and plastics and polyurethanes that furnish the inside of our house are also derived from petroleum, which means ultimately they are fuels. You get them up to temperature and they will burn like crazy, much more intensely than a wooden house will burn, than a traditional sofa with cotton batting in the upholstery and cotton pillows. If you've got nylon pillows and polyurethane in there, it's going to burn in a completely different way. And there's some really chilling videos that Underwriters Laboratories have posted on YouTube where you can see what an old-fashioned legacy living room looks like when it's on fire and what a modern living room looks like. And a modern living room will burn like a refinery fire and basically explode after about 3 minutes. And that gives people inside very little time to escape. And it also means the house is a goner. And so these are all new houses up in Fort McMurray, all built to these modern standards, which are very petroleum heavy and in fact, disastrously flammable. And in addition to that, because so many people work in industry there, you've got welding tanks, propane tanks, all kinds of things in the garages. Everybody's got a gas grill. Most people have multiple vehicles. So, you know, you think of snow tires, winter tires, summer tires, all those things become fuel when you get above 1,000 degrees. And basically, it was a feast for the fire, which made a seamless transition out of the black spruce and aspen forest and into these petroleum heavy neighborhoods.
There's a concept you mentioned in the book called the wild urban interface, which I guess can predict how this could happen again, because it has something to do with just how far away from a boreal forest, let's say, you're going to plant a city, if I can put it that way.
Yeah, it's called the WUI is what firefighters call it. It stands for the Wildland Urban Interface. And it's, Bob, it's where half of Americans live and 2/3 of Canadians live. And it's probably, frankly, where most Idahoans live. And it's the place where the forest, the wildland, butts up against the built environment. And we love being around trees. You know, we're a northern hemisphere forest people, and we take comfort from the forest. We want to build our homes in it. We want to recreate in it. But it's become a much more flammable and dangerous place. And Idaho is, you know, at great risk of wooey fires, these fires that come in out of the forest and then transition seamlessly into the built environment, into our own neighborhoods. And that, you know, we've seen devastating fires outside of Boulder, Colorado. We've seen them in Montana, all up and down the West Coast. Gatlinburg, Tennessee, believe it or not, had a terrible urban fire that came out of the forest back in 2016. Halifax, Nova Scotia, which is a small Canadian province, maritime province, basically where fog and rain are made, that burnt disastrously last summer. So it's something that I urge folks in Idaho to really pay close attention to, because you are in the wooey too.
Yes, well, thank you for that. What is the Lucretius problem, and how does it help explain human behavior when it comes to fires like Fort McMurray?
Yeah, Lucretius was a poet and philosopher who lived back in Roman times, about 1,000 years BC. And he observed people had a kind of perceptual limitation in which when you asked them, you know, what's the biggest mountain in the world, you know, they would say, you know, they would describe the biggest mountain that they had seen personally. And it was hard for them to imagine that there were bigger, greater things beyond their own experience. And this is a limitation that we have that carries through to this day. And it's actually really impacted wildfire fighters, because wildfire fighters have a lot of experience, but the experience they have is from the past. And in 2016, most of their fire experience was from the 1990s, the early 2000s, and none of them had experienced a fire as big and hot and intense as the one that came into Fort McMurray on May 3rd, 2016. And so they were basing their response to this wildfire that they could see coming at them from the forest, they were basing it on their experience from 10 years earlier. And they fought it that way. And in fact, climate change has change the nature of fire to the point that I coined a term, which is 21st century fire, because it really does burn in qualitatively different ways now. And one example is Fort McMurray, where, you know, we're in the subarctic, in the boreal forest, 600 miles north of the U.S. border. It's a cool, damp place. Historically, on May 3rd, the temperature was in the low 90s. It was like California, and the relative humidity was around 11 or 12%. And you have to go to Death Valley in July to find a comparable humidity. So now in the 21st century, you have the boreal forest system, which is already flammable, heated up to 93 degrees and dried out to 11%, which is like firewood. And then when you light that on fire, you don't just get a forest fire, you actually get an explosive firestorm situation. And that's where you get these pyrocumulonimbus clouds, which are these 40, 50,000 foot turning fire systems that move almost like hurricanes above giant fires. And we've had those, you know, in the American West, and we had 140 of these things in Canada just in 2023. And these are massive, devastating systems that generate their own lightning. They can start their own fires 20 or 30 miles away from the center, the burning center, which means they become kind of perpetual motion machines of fire that can move across the landscape and actually even generate their own tornadoes.
Yeah, I think you have a section in your book about Australia, and there was one of those fires. I think it was the Saturday night fire, whatever it's called, and what, 170 something people died.
That was Black Saturday 2009. The fire tornado was in 2003, but much closer to home, Bob, is the Redding fire tornado in Northern California in 2018. Mm-hmm. That killed five people. It generated winds comparable to an EF3 or EF4 tornado, and it destroyed everything in its path. And it, you know, it literally picked up, you know, F-250s and just threw them through the air, crushed them into a ball and burned them. It tore down 100-foot-tall high transmission lines, tore down the towers, It was extraordinary energy. And I walked the ground after that in August 2018, and it really looked like a nuclear bomb had gone off. I'd never seen destruction like that.
You know, when you were talking earlier, John, about how we're fighting fires by how it was to fight a fire 10 years ago, I couldn't help but think about one particular action that the firefighters took that I never really thought of before. But when it comes to bulldozing areas to protect or to stop the fire, they actually were bulldozing homes that weren't even on fire, were they not?
They were, Bob. And that is really radical. It is normal in firefighting to bulldoze down what's called a fire break or a fire guard or a cat guard. And that's, you know, you remove a swath of forest, you know, in front of the area you're trying to protect, and you hope that that will stop the flames. And, you know, one of the differences now between 21st century fire and other earlier fires is the embers fly farther because it's hotter and drier, and they ignite more effectively. So what's happening now is these embers are flying right over the fire breaks, right over the fire retardant lines and into the neighborhoods in the case of Fort McMurray. But things got so desperate at about 2 a.m. on May 5th, 2 days into the fire, that they started bulldozing brand new houses. And it was the only way they could see to stop the fire's relentless advance through this one neighborhood. And these are all, you know, these are $600,000 homes. They're a year old. This was the newest development in the city, and it was just getting mowed down by these flames. And so finally, in desperation, people brought in bulldozers and backhoes and basically tore down a fire break through the neighborhood. But the fire break was brand new, $500,000 homes. And that is a really big leap for people to make. And I just couldn't help but think of the firefighters and heavy equipment operators, many of whom who knew people who lived in those houses. You know, you're tearing down your friends and neighbors' houses, theoretically to save the larger community. But it's still a radical idea that nobody would come to naturally. I mean, you really have to really think outside the box and be under enormous pressure to go to those lengths. And that's how desperate it was. It was the right thing to do.
When it was all said and done, how many people were actually killed as a result of that fire?
Well, that's it's an interesting question, because nobody died in the flames, and it really is a miracle. And another thing complicating matters up there is Canada has a very high immigrant population. About 20% of the population are recent immigrants. And because Fort McMurray is a boom town, all kinds of new arrivals work up there. And so there were 80 first languages spoken in Fort McMurray when that fire broke out. And so you have all these different cultures, different religions, different ways of understanding risk and community. And somehow the net closed and got everybody out. And so, you know, that's an interesting way to understand Canada. It's a multinational, polyglot country that still values human life enough to save everybody. And so that was a real victory. But there were two fatalities the day after, when some teenagers who were, you know, I think probably running on no sleep, collided head on with a gas truck. They were killed. The gas truck exploded, started another fire. You know, it was a terrible tragedy. And then, you know, there's a fellow in the book who died later, but I think really in part, you know, from despair, from everything he lost in the fire. So these fires leave invisible wounds on the people who survive them. And there's a lot of PTSD. There's enormous financial hit. There is the trust and the faith that you lose in the world where you live. You know, is it going to turn on you again? You know, when is there going to be another fire? It hurts people in all kinds of ways.
Today, I'm speaking with John Valiant, author of Fire Weather. The book offers a terrifying account of a colossal wildfire and an exploration of the rapidly changing relationship between fire and humankind. Just for the sake of our listeners who haven't had a chance to read your book yet, you divide it into three parts. Part one and two is really about the fire itself for the most part, and it's just a brilliant explanation of how this all could have come about. But the third part is just as fascinating, if not more so, because it's climate science. And toward the end of that part, you'll give us an idea of what kind of reaction there's been in the financial world, for example, to the fires. But before we get there, I mean, this whole idea of climate science, you do a wonderful job of explaining that this isn't exactly news to us lately. You can take this back to the 19th century.
You can. And a lot of, you know, science is dry and kind of opaque for a lot of people. And I really had to struggle with a lot of this, but it's actually really fascinating. And in fact, people understood the basics of the greenhouse effect by the late 1700s. They realized that there was a kind of vapor barrier. They didn't quite understand what it was composed of, but they understood that for some reason, heat was held closer to the Earth's surface. By the 1850s, they'd isolated CO2, and they knew that it retained heat better than regular air. So they understood by the 1850s, this is before the invention of the automobile, that an increased amount of CO2 in our atmosphere would make the atmosphere hotter, would hold heat in. And that's, of course, exactly what's happened. By the 1890s, when coal burning was really expanding and the Industrial Revolution was well underway, there were already scientists speculating that, boy, you know, there's a lot of CO2 in coal smoke. If we keep expanding coal burning the way we are in 1895, we could actually change the climate on planet Earth. So people, there were, you know, some real visionaries out there who were looking at the science, who had an understanding of the basic principles and saw this reality coming. And by the 1960s, petroleum companies were doing their own science because they understood, you know, when you burn stuff, you generate CO2. When you're burning petroleum products or any kind of fossil fuel, coal, natural gas, oil, you're generating CO2, and they did their own research on it. And Exxon, in the 1980s, it was the biggest, most powerful company in the world, could, of course, afford the best scientists. Those scientists did what they were told, and they studied the impact of petroleum burning on the atmosphere and understood and predicted the warming that we are now experiencing. So the petroleum companies knew where we were going. And it is deeply concerning and possibly criminal that they did nothing to avoid it. In fact, to this day, they are minimizing the impacts of the industry on our atmosphere.
So take us up to the here and now, and let's talk about Mark Carney and the insurance companies, big oil these days. A few things happened as a result of this Fort McMurray fire. Of course, it could also have been any number of other fires that is convincing the financial world that investments in big oil may not be what it used to be.
Well, there's no question that big oil is under pressure and under scrutiny that it never was when you and I were young. And Mark Carney is an interesting guy. He's an economist who actually was born in Alberta, you know, came out of oil country, really went a long way, became a governor of the Bank of England. And in 2015, before the Fort McMurray fire, he was saying, folks, you know, we are making these big investments in petroleum and chemical products and all kinds of things. And we really need to focus on the risk that climate change poses to these investments. And he was kind of a bit of a voice in the wilderness back then. But now it's becoming much clearer that climate change is not just bad for human health. It's not just bad for the natural world, but it also really impacts markets and it really impacts industry. And in fact, the Fort McMurray fire shut down the entire bitumen industry in Fort McMurray. And it was the first time it had ever been shut down to that extent by fire. The fires last summer in 2023, which was really the black summer of Canada, burnt from coast to coast, shut down petroleum operations and all kinds of other industrial operations again. And so climate poses a real hazard, not just to our lives and physical safety, but to the way our economy and industries function.
Tell us about what you call the beginning of the end of the Petrocene age. It took place in The Hague District Court in the Netherlands. And we'll close on that because this is an optimistic note.
It is. All of us were raised in the middle of what I call the Petrocene age, which I say start around 1860. The first oil wells are dug in the late 1850s. The automobile is prototyped in 1860. Standard Oil, now Exxon, was founded in 1870. And our world became increasingly dependent on liquid petroleum to power it. And we're all the beneficiaries of that. It's enabled us to travel and prosper in ways no one ever has been able to before. At the same time, these climate impacts of this mode of generating energy are really coming back to bite us. And there was a historic lawsuit in the Netherlands against Royal Dutch Shell. Shell is the second biggest oil company after Exxon. You know, Aramco is big too in Saudi, but Shell is one of the big three. And a group called Friends of the Earth sued them and won the suit in The Hague, which is, you know, one of the biggest courts in Europe, requiring Shell to reduce its emissions back to, I think it's 1990s levels. And that is a colossal step forward, really, for our climate in terms of really connecting the dots between the impact these industries have on our world and the need to mitigate the amount of emissions that they emit, and really putting some teeth in that. And so this is a binding ruling, and Shell, of course, will appeal it. But it's clear now that it's like those early victories against the tobacco industry back in the 70s and 80s. This very powerful industry that is very well defended, finally having to come to terms with the fact that its impacts on human health and on the world have to be reckoned with, and they have to take responsibility for it. So I think there are going to be more lawsuits like that. There are currently thousands of climate lawsuits in the works. Suncor, which is a Canadian company but has offices down in Denver, they were just ordered to pay a $10 million plus suit for simply polluting the air around Denver. So things are moving. And the other really positive thing that we need to focus on is this incredible energy transition that we're going through right now. More and more states and more countries are deriving well over 50% of their electricity from renewables, from solar and wind principally. But it's an exciting time, a very dynamic time. The stakes, though, couldn't be higher.
Well, I'm going to close with a quote that you took from a University of Illinois professor describing rising global temperatures. And she said, don't think of it as the warmest month of August in the last century. Think of it as the coolest months of August in the next century. Boy, if you stop and think about that, John, your book holds true. And we want to thank you for writing it. I want to thank you for taking a few minutes to be with us here at Reader's Corner. Again, the name of the book, Fire Weather, A True Story from a Hotter World by John Valiant. Thanks so much, John.
Bob, so good to be with you, and take care, Idaho.
Reader's Corner is presented by Boise State Public Radio News. The engineer for today's show is Eric Jones, with production by Joel Wayne. I'm Bob Kustra. Please join me next week as we talk to today's leading writers about the ideas and issues that help shape our world at Reader's Corner.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.